Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Flat Nickel Podcast. This week, your host, Hannah Margaret Nawa, and myself, Sam Fritz, sit down with Roebuck, consisting of Philip and Phoenix Roebuck. After years of touring as a one-man band, Philip Roebuck has paired up with his wife and stand-up bass player, Phoenix, to form the raucous, swampy, bluesy duo, Roebuck. We had the honor of sitting down with Philip and Phoenix on a stormy night after their performance at the Thought Lot to discuss their recent tour with The Devil Makes Three, the magic of making music, and the intensity of their performances. First, let's set the scene. This interview took place the day after our interview with the Herd of Main Street. It was around 9 at night, and the storm was raging on. Philip and Phoenix sat on the couch across from us, and Philip opened a can of seltzer water to begin the interview.
Wouldn't it be funny if you were like, okay, we're recording, and I'm like, well, it was, you know, and I talk in this grand, anyway.
Almost news anchor voice.
Yeah, like. Yeah.
Pretty much, I haven't actually gotten a chance to talk to you a little bit about what we're doing.
Right.
Pretty
I've
much.
Been piecing it together, you know.
Pretty much, I've been working with independent musicians for the past 5 years, and I find that the stories of touring and songwriting are very unique, interesting stories, and I want to sort of capture that and share that with the world. So we're going to be traveling a little bit this summer and sort of documenting these stories and asking just about, you know, your process as songwriters, your experiences touring, and really just, one, hopefully promote the bands and the artists that we love and that we want to support, and also have these stories for posterity, essentially. Posterity.
Yeah.
So as far as, you guys are married, right?
Is we that, are married. We've been married. Coming up on 7 years.
Oh, you remembered.
Yeah.
Great. And you obviously had projects prior to your involvement in the act. Mm-hmm. Has your songwriting or how, I guess, your sound changed at all since you've been involved with the project? Are you sort of writing in a different style or is it just sort of been amplified?
Oh, it's absolutely changed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, it's in a very good way. I mean, I know we do run into people who really liked the one-man band thing that mm-hmm. I was doing. But and I've also, you know, when I started out, like in my teen years and stuff, I was in a rock band. And you kind of write for whatever your medium is, you just naturally start to, okay, well, now we have this, we have drums, we have guitar, we have bass, you know, and you, as a songwriter, you just immediately sort of, or instinctually start writing for your ensemble, you know, what you are, and I guess I did that, the solo one-man band gig for, 16, 17 years, something like that.
Yeah, it was a long time.
It was a long time. Too long. but I would, you know, and I had just those things. I had the drum rig, which was two things. It was a bass drum and a tambourine. And then I had the banjo. And then I had my voice. And those were my four band members. And I would, you know, had to write everything to work for that and be dynamic and, you know, could sort of be able to, you know, cover the whole spectrum with just that limited range. So when Phoenix came into the mix, learning the bass, it felt exponential. I mean, it was just, suddenly it was like, wow, we're like an orchestra up here now, you know? So anyway, yeah, and the writing has changed a lot. Also, Phoenix is singing now, which she wasn't really singing at the very beginning. That's a newer development, and so that's another instrument mm-hmm. in the band, another voice, you know. I guess I'm trying to think how it's changed, really. I think there's a lot more subtlety, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, we come across pretty, not subtle, but there's a lot more subtlety to it now than there was when I was solo. And we really dig into the ballads and go for the as quiet as we can, and then we get as full and raucous as we can at times.
That was the word that I thought almost as sort of, we were talking a little bit last night at dinner and about sort of the stomp and holler and the,
yeah,
and the blues and all the sort of influences of your guys's, not influences, but ways, mm-hmm, I guess, descriptors of your sound. And raucous in the best possible way. Like, for me, is how, like, it's such a full sound for being the two of you. And you guys are excellent performers. Like,
Thank you.
Sitting with him last night and we were watching, I was like, I'm so glad that I get to experience this with someone I know appreciates it as much as I do. But it was just such a mesmerizing performance. Mm. You know, I feel like when you're in music for a certain amount of time, you kind of have acts where, yeah, of course they're great and they're, you know, they're amazing and you want to support them. And then you have those ones that sort of leave you speechless. Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt after watching you guys. Wow. It was just such like a great, amazing performance.
The thing that I picked up on right away was, you guys started intense. Mm-hmm. And there are certain bands and artists that you kind of have to wait for them to get into their groove and when, mm-hmm, they think that they're feeling it. But you guys both started, you know, full on, you know, getting the crowd into it. Yes. And I actually noticed, especially with your guitar playing and you with the upright bass, there was a moment when you had that thing above your head.
Which, first of all, what is your workout plan?
Yes, seriously. But is there ever a moment where the intensity gets to, like, has the intensity ever steered you wrong, I guess? You know, has it ever, you dropped a pick and then you just couldn't recover the song or anything like that?
Or even do you have crowds that, like, don't respond well to that? Because I think for people who love music and love performers, mm-hmm, that's a great thing. But depending on the crowds that you're playing, I feel like there might be some people who that doesn't register.
Yes and yes. I have definitely dropped my pick and not been able to recover. I have this little cigar box that screws onto my mic stand that has extra picks in it and stuff like that. And sometimes I'm able to grab one and keep going, you know. I have a really strong instinct as a performer to really sell it and bring it home, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've gone home with bloody fingers, you know, trying to sell that last chorus because I dropped my pick or whatever. because that's what it's about. It's about that moment. And if you just let it go, it's really over. And that was the one time that that one person was able to see you. So why would you just let it fizzle out? So I strongly believe in going all the way every time. You know, and also I believe, and you brought up, you know, how we started strong. I really believe in hitting it hard right away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and especially when we play shows that are not in a cozy environment like this with candlelight and, you know, and dim lights and it's nighttime. We'll have to play things in the morning sometimes. You know, that's when it really matters the most, you know, is being able to, you don't have the luxury of ramping it up. You know, you got to jump right in. And the audience will go along with it. They're like, oh, we're rocking out right away. Okay, great. And they're right there with you, you know. And then sometimes not only is the audience not responsive, sometimes there is no audience, really, yeah, you know. It can be, you can't rely on getting feedback and fuel from the audience. It has to come from internal, internal of the band, whatever. And that's a huge ethic that we have had all along. I've had it for years by myself. It was really a survival instinct, was, you know, kind of put my head down. Doesn't matter how many people are out there. Could be 2,000, could be two. I've played to both, really, you know, and the ethic that we have is that play the show like it's your last. What if we don't have another one, you know? And as I get older, that gets more and more realistic. And I try to remember that because sometimes I kind of do feel over it when nobody's clapping and there's eight people and they want to go home too. And you're just like, yeah. But That's when it really, really helps me to lean into that work ethic and like, why am I doing this then? You know, let's have a moment here. And Phoenix luckily has adopted that. And so we are that as a band. Mm. We have that same ethic. And it was funny because we were playing a lot. Well, I don't want to get us too off track. I feel like I pretty much answered that question. Did you want to add anything to that?
I mean, I think we've only... to the question of like letting a moment fizzle out or something, I think the only thing that's ever happened in terms of that is like you broke a string and you couldn't keep going. Mm. But then as soon as you would like rip the string off, we'd start back in at 110%. Mm-hmm. just go. That was fun.
And sometimes there is a technical issue like that, yeah, where a string breaks. And if it breaks, it's not that big a deal. Usually I can keep going, but sometimes it'll tangle itself up in the strings and the guitar literally doesn't work. Yeah. And so there'll be a moment of me like getting it out of the way and then like, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, go. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
But again,
I like those
usually
moments.
I do too. Usually the audience is with us. They're seeing this happen. So they know what's going on, you know, and they are supporting this and they want it to succeed, you know. So for the most part, the audience is usually on our side, you know, any performer's side.
I think one of the things that was really also really obvious last night was you guys really enjoy playing together. On like just the sort of chemistry that you guys had on stage was, there were just sort of these little things that I would see you guys do or ways I would see you guys look at each other. And I was like, yeah, no, they're, you can tell that you guys enjoy this. And I think sometimes it can be, especially when you're working with your partner, can be sort of, there are very unique challenges that come with that. Were you guys working together creatively beforehand? Did you guys meet and then decide like, hey, let's make music together? Or how did that develop? Were you guys
well, first of all, I do want to say there's a lot of communication that goes on that I think I know the things that you're talking about, that you could probably see and witness as an audience member, but there's actually a lot going on. I think this is true for most bands. Like there's a lot of communication going on in the music, like without us even looking at each other. She'll do something or I'll do something or whatever. The music gets steered instinctually, you know, through.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's a communication, a give and take, and oh, we're going this way. We're bringing this verse way down. For some reason, we've never done this. I hope it works. Or we're going crazy. We're doubling this chorus, you know, whatever that is. And it has nothing. There's no signals there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that I love about it. About music in general is that sort of spontaneous decision making and communicating, you know. Yeah, so I love that. And then the other part,
it's just like an understanding,
mm-hmm,
or something. Because I don't even have to look at you, I just hear one note differently. And I'm like, oh,
we're doing that now.
We're going this way. All right, you know.
And see, and that, what she just said, is also incredibly valuable as a band member and a partner on stage, because not every musician you plop on stage with you is going to have that instinct and feel that difference. And I don't think it's, I know actually it doesn't just have to do with the amount of time we spend together. A lot of musicians can drop into a band, sometimes a band they've never heard, and still have listened that acutely and move with the changes of the band. Those are really good musicians. You know, they're listeners and they adapt to it. They want to take the ride, you know. They're not looking to just survive it, you know. But the majority of musicians don't necessarily have that.
Mm.
It's a real, that's why bands stay together. That's why you have bands that stay together for decades, is because of that magic little thing that not just any musician can drop in there and feel that, you know. And the other part of your question about how it came together, mm-hmm, Phoenix did not play the bass when we met.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you play any instrument at all?
Nope.
And did you just decide that was the instrument for you? Was there sort of a suggestion of like, this would sound really good?
Well, no.
I was touring hardcore at the time. I was playing like 200 shows a year. She had just taken over the management side, and we were touring together, and you know, so she was, I
was at every single show he played from the time we started being together, and 200 shows a year, every show I was there listening, following along. I could hear his nuances and when he would, you know, change pace or, you know, go in a different direction and stuff. But I wanted to play with him from the beginning.
Did you start with stand-up bass, or did you learn on a reg? Because in my opinion, I learned with, you know, a fretted guitar. So I have to imagine starting without frets is almost more frustrating than starting with.
I hate frets.
Really?
She started only with the upright. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I find frets really limiting and frustrating, actually.
There's a lot going on between those frets.
Yes, there is.
So I understand that. I appreciate that.
Yeah, but Phil was composing music for a play when I got my first upright bass. He needed a violin for a song he was writing, and his was being repaired. So he's like, just find a cheap one on Craigslist. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay. And I searched, and I found this sweet old woman in Boston getting rid of a ton of instruments. And one of them was a violin, and one was an upright bass.
Both of them were like 100 years old.
Yeah, you mentioned the really old bass last night at dinner. I was going to ask you, was that the same person that was the bass from?
That was the bass. Yeah, belonged to her uncle.
One owner.
Yeah.
It's entire, crazy. Like a 100-year-old bass that had one owner, wow. You know. And then she inherited it, you know.
Yeah, she wanted like $300 for it. And I looked at it, and I was like, man, I always wanted to try an upright bass, like, you know, see if I could do it.
Well, she had talked about the upright bass a while, but they're kind of steep to get into financially to just try it out.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. It's like a kind of an investment. It's a risk, you know?
Definitely. And yeah, when she said $300, I couldn't give her the money fast enough. And I like ran out of there with the bass and
his It was the ideal home that the woman was looking for. She wanted someone who would play it and would love it the way her uncle did. You know, it was that story. And it completely, you know, gave her a musical career, opened her up as a musician. It was exactly, you know, the instrument meant for her.
Yeah.
The only reason that we got another bass at all was because we were touring in a Buick LeSabre. And an upright bass in a sedan is not a good passenger.
Yeah, you guys said that you sort of you were touring as if you were in an airplane. It was one behind the other because you had to lay down the seats to put the bass into the
down the passenger seat, put the bass in, and then someone would drive and the other person sit directly behind and lean over and talk, you know, like that. But we got this the Chadwick folding bass, and it's so cool. It, you know, the neck folds into the body, and it fit in the trunk of the Buick, and it just changed our lives.
Yeah.
And so the other bass, and it was a very good thing because that old bass did not deserve to be out on the road. It deserved to be in our studio. And it lives, you know, a very sedate life there. It gets played daily, but it doesn't have to take a beating of touring. And that's a good thing because, yeah, the instruments get tired, you know?
I love that you guys talk about it like it has a soul almost. Like the way you describe it, it almost has like this magical quality to it, which is so good to hear. I think that's.
Well, when she bought the bass, the woman gave her a photograph of her uncle with the bass in like 1920, standing there with his bass in the jazz band, you know, it definitely has a soul.
It's an incredible piece of history.
Yeah.
It just has this really warm, rich tone to it that I haven't heard with another bass either.
There's that too, yeah.
I love my bass that I have now, of course, and Charlie, who makes them, is just one of the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. very talented, and I love that bass, but this one is, yeah, its own entity, and it changed my life. So I guess it has that going for it too.
Yeah.
But
we wouldn't be able to do what we do without the folding bass. Yeah.
Are
it's
you,
great.
Are you
we
guys
fly
in
with
a,
it.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah.
That is really cool. Yeah. Are you guys in a van now, or are you?
We're in a van now. And honestly, the fact that the bass folds up is great.
Still great,
it's
yeah.
Still great.
Still saves a lot of room.
Space, for some reason, is still a commodity.
Yeah.
You know?
It's definitely still a commodity.
Yeah.
How often do you guys tour? Are you mostly on the road? Are you mostly at home base? How often are you guys? Sort of like a rough estimate. How many shows are you guys playing?
Yeah, you know, like I said earlier, you know, I was doing about 200 shows a year for a while, all on the road. Now we play about 150. That's what we did last year. And that's sort of what we're expecting for this year. Mm-hmm. And about half of those are on the road and the rest are at home. It's basically been increasing each year. This is basically our third year as a band, right? Yeah, it's our third year as a band now. And so the first year was pretty much all at home except for a little handful. And then the next year was about half. And so this year we're expecting it to be, or planning it, for it to be more out-of-town shows. And that's a very deliberate thing because we've been sort of cocooning and developing our sound. Woodshedding, you know, the musician mm-hmm. term. Trying to find it. Find our sound as a band. Find our sound, you know. You know, sometimes you want to work, get something figured out before you just start go showboating around the country. You know, you wanted to have it together.
I brought this up to you, the photo of you guys, and like you're laying in bed and you're eating that gas station burrito. For me, that's one of the most on the road things that I could ever imagine, is just you sitting there on the side of the bed eating that little gas station burrito.
It's a story there, isn't it?
Yeah. All those photos of you, I think any photo I've seen of you guys is just, you can tell that there's a story there. And there's I don't know. Do you guys have such... You guys photograph very well. I'll leave it at that. It is something very enticing about this. I do want to ask you, and then we'll probably sort of, we'll plug anything that you guys want to mention. But I need to ask you about Drop Dead Diva. I need to know how that happened, why that happened, because... I need to, because I'm not saying that I had this like little obsession with that show when it was on, but
you did.
But I did. I did.
Phil's an actor.
That's one of my other things that I love and do. I've always done it since I was a little kid, and that was an opportunity that came up. That was great because it married music and acting mm-hmm. together, you know, which is ideal for me. And I had to audition for that part, and there was a song in it, and it's in the show, but it wasn't written at the time. Rick Springfield wrote the song that you hear in the show now, but when I auditioned for it, there was no song there. It was just lyrics written in the script. And then, so I had to act out the parts, and then it, you know, the action was, okay, now he sings this verse of the song. So I wrote a song, you know, to fit the lyrics and recorded it and used that for the audition, and it got me the part, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, okay, cool, you know, so I got the part, and then, yeah, I got to work with Jay DeMarcus from Rascal Flatts, which was fantastic. And then Rick Springfield, who is just one of my favorite people.
Yeah,
he was great.
Yeah, and, we're still friends. We still see him whenever, you know, when he comes to our town or something, we'll get together and have dinner. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I wrote the song, got the part, went down there to Atlanta is where we did it, and then we worked on it. It was great because we shot for like 2 days, and then this ice storm hit, and so we were all sort of stuck in the hotel, and they stopped production for a week, and they went, I mean, those guys like Jay and Rick went back to Nashville and stuff, but then that first night we were all kind of stuck there together and just, you know, just had a great, you know, ice storm hotel night, yeah. You know, it was awesome. And then, and working with Rick was great because we had to rehearse, you know, he came to my hotel room, we had to rehearse the song and work on that and work out harmonies and stuff. And he's just, he's a great person, a great musician. What else do you want to know about it?
I kind of caught me off guard when I was researching your, I was like on the website and
it seemed kind of out of nowhere a little bit.
I'm about it. I don't know how it happened, but I'm okay with it. Like I'm totally down for it. Yeah, it was just a really cool thing because I think when those sort of just, in a weird way, like past life, like sort of just my childhood or upbringing or whatever, and now it's trickled into my career. When I see people who are have done other projects outside of music, or even like I'm really close friends with Brittany and Andrew Carter from the band If Birds Could Fly, and their song was featured in The Big Sick, which was this really highly praised movie that came out last year. And so to sort of see people I know do other projects that I'm familiar with or that other people are familiar with, because so often I work in independent music. If I'm talking about bands, nobody knows what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I was sitting with Sam's roommate and I was talking about I'm producing music videos now. And he's like, I'm going to guess it's nothing I've ever seen because if it's not top 40, I've not heard of it. And I'm just sitting there. Right. How do you not?
Yeah.
But it was just a very cool thing, I think, for me. When things come full circle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, two worlds get to collide. I love that too. I know what you're talking about.
Do you guys have a lot of those sort of bonding moments with other musicians where, you know, you're talking about sitting in the hotel room and rehearsing and you sort of became friends with them. Is that something that's common for you guys on the road? I know you did the tour with Devil Makes Three, right? Mm-hmm. T-shirt. You know.
Oh, yeah, I'm wearing a Devil Makes Three t-shirt.
And I saw some of the photos from the photographer that was
Jay Westcott.
Yes, was on that tour.
He also did the photo you like of the gas station burrito.
Yeah. do you guys find that you've made sort of those lasting bonds with musicians that you've worked with? Are you guys sort of the passing through the night? You know, hey, it was nice to meet you. Or
I usually
no.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, those connections are rare, the deep connections. There's a general support and friendliness among musicians that I love, for the most part, right? It's the musicians are nice to each other and supportive.
Because we all understand what, like, being a musician is.
No matter what level you are, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, really what you're talking about, like the deeper connections and staying friends and all that, that's rare. That's rare because it's such a turbulent sea that we're all sailing. It's hard to keep a line, you know, going. So I really value those real connections. And they tend to last over the years, regardless of ups and downs of careers and fame and all that, which you would think would sever them, you know, but they tend to hang on. I think we should answer separately on this.
Okay.
I mean, you know, just because, I mean, just, it's a perspective thing, you know. For me, I look for that. I do want that, but I think I am kind of a passing ship in the night, like you said. You know, like, it's hard for me to hang on to those things. And
I mean, I'm a pretty social person. even though when we're home, I don't want to leave the house ever. But when I am in, you know, social situations and we're working with other musicians, you know, I'm always looking for, you know, that connection and finding your tribe.
Yeah.
And it's happened a lot with musicians.
Finding your tribe, yeah, that's a good way to put it, yeah.
And there's just little moments, and they don't always happen because, you know, as Phil was saying, it's very fleeting. Like, you know, we play a set, then they play a set, then it's like, we gotta go. You know, that's it. Like, we don't usually get hang time to get to know one another. And it's when we have, like, when everybody's gone, there's a few drinks laying around, and there's, like, an instrument or two left that something magical can happen.
Or something unfortunate, like, oh, your van broke down. And then you work on the van together, and, like, that becomes the basis of your friendship, you know? Things like that. You know, or fixing a guitar, or loaning a guitar string or an amp or whatever, you know. Things like that.
Yeah, you working on that song with Rick was... And then for me, it was... He broke his laptop, so I drove him around town helping him get a new laptop and helping him restore his hard drive in a panic. And that's how we all bonded. But, yeah, things like that.
I heard you guys were up pretty late in the lobby last night. Yeah. Apparently my dad didn't come home till like 2 in the morning.
Yeah, no, it was fun. We were sitting around talking.
Your dad is so wonderful.
Yes,
he is. Such a wonderful human being.
Yeah, we kept checking in with the clock. We're like, okay, well, it's 11:30. We should probably call it. And then we'd get talking about something.
About something. And then we do it again. Yeah. All
right, well, it's midnight. We should probably. And then we get talking about something else.
Yeah.
Half hour check-ins.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good.
So you guys toured with The Devil Makes Three. For some reason, that's a tongue twister every time I try and say it. And that was the beginning of January?
Yes. This year, it was right at the beginning. It was 10 shows, I think, we did with them. And it was, doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're touring in January to Minneapolis and Montreal and Chicago, you know.
Just where everybody wants to go in January. Like the top tourist destinations for the dead of winter.
Yes, exactly. There was a lot of snow involved and a lot of negative temperatures. It was a wonderful time.
Yeah, you are. You got the Illinois, Chicago, like.
I was enjoying it, actually. I was like, oh, the snow is so nice. And he's, like, shaking and clinging to the dashboard. Like, we're gonna die! I was like, no, we're not.
And the shows were great. They were so fun. And, you know, I've toured with them before, solo. And so we have a relationship with them. We really love those guys. But this was our first tour with them as a band, you know. And it was... It was even better. I mean, I really, really loved it. It went really well.
It was cool, too. It also gave Lucia and I, like, a little extra boost because we're both female upright bass players. So there was, like, this kind of girl power thing that happened with that. I'm normally not all, like, you're so brave for being a woman. But...
Someone understands my struggles of, like, you know, I'm surrounded by men in this van. And it's
right.
Yeah, it's I do realize every once in a while that, you know, it doesn't hit me until people tell me, they're like, I don't see female upright bass players very often. I'm like, it's like all the women I know are upright bass players, it seems. But I guess you're right. I guess it's not a thing you see very often.
But for that tour, we were already in the studio recording an album. It was going to be our first album. When we got the gig, basically, and we realized that we thought we had about a window of about 2 months to record this album. And so we had our home studio all set up, and we would go in and rehearse a little bit and record a little bit. We were really taking our time, you know? And then suddenly we were like, you know what? If we want to bring a CD on this tour because it was a bit of a short notice. we have 3 days to complete it and send it to be pressed or whatever.
And
we did that. It wound up being an EP. There are 7 songs on it. But we're very proud of it. It, the thing that we really wanted to capture was the live energy. So it's all live. There's no overdubs or anything. And we set up our studio like the same arrangement that Sun Studios was set up, you know, when Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and all those guys recorded. And so it had this kind of hot, kinetic energy to it. We captured the songs that worked and made this album. And it, so basically it's our debut record now. Even though we recorded it rushed, we're pretty happy with it.
Who was doing the, because Jay Westcott did those photos of you guys. Was there someone else doing the videography?
No, it was all Jay.
It was all him?
He was amazing, running all around the place, because I...
Yeah, because he was shooting us and the Devil Makes Three photos for both, and then a video for us. I don't know if he was shooting a video for them, but we told him at the beginning, we need to walk away with the video. We don't have one, really. So he was doing both. Double duty there.
Yeah. I brought him on tour to document it, handle social media, because I'm terrible at social media.
But we're going to, hopefully, now that the album's out, we got home, we had not intended to release it. We were only selling the physical CDs, but we decided to put it out, digitally so people could download it and stuff. Because we kept getting emails after the tour, like, oh, I didn't buy your CD at the merch table. I didn't know that you can't get it online, So we're like, all right, I guess we'll put it online, So we did that. But now we're going to release a video, which is what we're talking about. Yeah, I think we're going to do a video for the very first song on there, which is an old traditional tune called Green Sally Up. So there should be a video coming out for that.
And then this summer, you guys have a show and then headed back home here soon.
Yes.
And then you guys are going to be touring over the summer up through Canada for some festivals.
Yeah.
Which is very exciting.
So excited.
Try and get my passport between now and then.
Not that far away from here, actually. We're going to be in Quebec, which is just due north of here, And that's where we went with the Devil Makes Three when we came down and just had the best time up there. I had never been to Quebec or Canada, I guess, at all. And, it was, we loved it. And we got asked to come back and play these festivals, the Sherbrooke Festival and then the Bromont Blues Festival, both in July. So we're really excited to go back up there. And that'll also give us an excuse to play up in New England, which we just, we just don't play up there often enough. So we're really excited about that.
And we'll post all of the information about the video and the upcoming dates through all of our social for the podcast. So if you guys are interested in coming and seeing them live, which you absolutely should. Sam and I pretty much last night just kept talking about how mesmerizing you guys were. And it was such a great experience for us to share together, been the first artists that we're doing this podcast with. It was a great first experience for us. The last question that I want to ask you guys is if there's sort of any musicians or artists that you guys have been listening to a lot lately that you would like to recommend for our audience to go and check out, just sort of spread the chain of love throughout the community. So if there's someone that you guys have worked with or that you guys have heard recently that you guys just really want to mention.
I'm thinking.
Obviously, I feel like we can throw The Devil Makes Three in there.
Yeah. You can always throw The Devil Makes Three in there. They're great, great guys.
Oh boy!
But
there's a very long list running.
through my head, but I'm also mixing up people that are dead with people that we know because we listen to a lot of people that are dead.
That's so true.
I think that's really common. I hear that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in terms of musicians that are working now,
and
like...
still, yeah, alive and doing working, it and, that and people don't know much about.
There's a lot.
Yeah, there's so
but
many.
But there's just as many dead musicians that are equally as influential, you know?
That people don't know about.
I mean, Alan Lomax is the... who I owe the greatest debt to. I mean, he ethnomusicologist who collected folk music from all around the country.
Yeah.
He spent his life doing that.
Yeah.
And he did such a thorough job too. He made sure he got the lyrics and who the person was that was singing, and you know, it, he just that music is life changing. I mean, it's not even life-changing. It's a life unto itself that you could just live in that world forever and never hear any other songs and be fine. You know? People who have discovered that music, you know, or have been aware of it throughout their lives know what I'm talking about. If you have no idea about Alan Lomax's music collection that he did for the Smithsonian... Folkways,
Library of Congress.
Library of Congress. You know, this was all supported. Mm-hmm. It was his career, you know. But he rescued and saved, you know, this music that would otherwise have just disappeared.
Yeah.
Mostly because the people who sung that music aren't alive anymore. And there was no other way for it to survive. Unless their children had learned it by osmosis, you know, or whatever the word would be there, orally. Anyway, so Alan Lomax.
I'm just thinking of our friends that we've, like, toured with that I think are wonderful musicians as well, like Sean K. Preston.
Mm-hmm. Morgan O'Kane.
Morgan O'Kane, Jake Orvis.
Yeah.
Who is also part of a fun band called the Goddamn Gallows. They're actually playing in Altoona pretty soon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Really, really great people there. Billy Cook, really good.
Yeah. He it depends. It depends on what, you know, I don't know what, there's, I don't know what people like to listen to. I listen to all kinds of different music.
Yeah.
That's kind of, that's part of it. You know, a lot of New Orleans music, you know, Preservation Hall, jazz band, and anyway.
Also, Lila Blue, who we produced an album for.
Yeah.
Actually, in our studio. She's a...
She's a young songwriter. She lives in San Francisco, and yeah, she's phenomenal.
She got, I think, best album of the year in San Francisco, the album we did for her. So that's 2016 or something. She's 17 right now.
Wow.
Yeah, she's an incredibly prolific songwriter. I'm still thinking of dead people.
I feel like that's a good note to go out on. I'm still thinking of dead people.
Yeah. There's just so much out there. I mean, yeah. I guess that's why you're asking. Yeah. Like, how do we, you know, how do you boil it down? I mean, for me, I always, whenever I found someone I loved, you know, like Tom Waits and Bob Dylan, all, you know, the
Replacements.
The Replacements, you know, all of the heavy hitters, you know, for me, that were so influential. I always just dug into what they were listening to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the best advice you can really give anybody. You know, if you can find out who the person, the people that, the artists that you love the most, find out what they listen to, you know, and then, so basically what that means is you wind up going further and further back in time. That's why I keep bringing up these old recordings, you know.
they're definitely a key element to who we are as a band and our music. I mean, Phil introduced me to the Alan Lomax Field Recordings, of course, when I met him, and it changed my whole world and my view of all of it. It really is the basis for all music that exists today.
I mean, there's a lot. There's so many. We're this. Oh man, this could very easily become a rant. Really pull the reins tight here.
Come on.
But the majority of us, as people or Americans, I guess, only hear pop music. And when I say pop, I mean pretty much everything you can spin on the dial on the radio. You know, maybe NPR. You can, you know, land on some classical or some jazz or something. But I'm talking everything from rap to country to dance music or, you know, I don't know. It's called pop music, but I refer to everything as pop. It's really, you know, everything is pop music. But there's so much
that people
invisible know. Music to us that we don't even realize. There's so much music from the. I mean, there are songs right now that you and I could sing together, and you know, we just met, but that we both know that neither one of us have ever heard on the radio. Mm-hmm. That is what I'm talking about. That's true folk music that somehow works its way into our bones, regardless of what our upbringing is or anything, even our religions or anything. It's like, see, it is turning into a rant. Anyway, I love music like that, that transcends any commercial, you know, the marketing of music and all of that, and a hit single and blah blah blah. Yeah, we all know that song, but what about this one? You know. Anyway.
This concludes our interview with Roebuck. If you'd like to find any additional information regarding the band, tour dates are available on philiproebuck.com. We would also like to mention that you can follow us. We're available on iTunes, Podomatic, and we have social media accounts on Twitter at the Flat Nickel Podcast and on Instagram at Flat Nickel Podcast. Please be sure to like the podcast and follow wherever you may be listening. We will soon be available on Spotify as well. Be sure to tune in again next week. Thank you, and have a good night.